Welcome to the podcast series for AJP Heart and Circulatory Physiology. I'm your host, Kara Hansel-Kehan. Today, we'll discuss the new Guidelines in Cardiovascular Research article by Poole et al. Titled, Guidelines for Animal Exercise and Training Protocols for Cardiovascular Studies. This article published April 21st, 2020. Joining me today are Associate Editor Mario Delmar, Editor-in-Chief Irv Zucker, and authors Timothy Mush, David Poole, Michael Sturrock, Donald O'Leary, and Stephen Kopp. Let's get started.
Thank you all for joining this podcast. I think there is wide agreement that exercise training provides a variety of protective effects on cardiovascular and pulmonary function. In reality, the literature is voluminous on the salutary effects of exercise training on almost every organ system and in just about every species investigated. In terms of integrative physiological mechanisms, exercise is a prototypical intervention. Even though we have been studying the effects of exercise training on cardiopulmonary function for decades, there is still no consensus on the best way of carrying out exercise and the underlying mechanisms by which different types of exercise would be beneficial for various disorders. In an attempt to provide guidance for investigators using animal models of exercise training, the current Guidelines in Cardiovascular Physiology was developed by an outstanding group of physiologists who have worked in this area for many years. This paper represents a consensus statement on best practices for carrying out exercise training in various species. Each species clearly has its own challenges and limitations. Uniformity in each exercise modality and normalization of training strategies across groups has been highly variable in the literature. Investigators starting out in this field will find this paper a useful resource that we hope will help choose the appropriate model for their questions and hypotheses. The two lead authors on this guidelines paper are Tim Mush and David Poole from Kansas State University. Maybe we can start by having Tim and David summarize the main issues when choosing an appropriate model as outlined in the paper. Then we can have each author discuss the pros and cons of their particular animal model, hopefully with a practical focus on the use of each model for studying cardiopulmonary mechanisms. We will then have a free-flowing discussion among the authors. So, Tim, if I can start with you, could you please outline the considerations an investigator needs to think about before starting an exercise study?
Yes. There are multiple questions and practical issues an investigator will face when selecting the most appropriate animal species and exercise paradigm to use. So the purpose of the review was to pull together the collective expertise necessary to help investigators navigate those questions. It is well known that exercise presents the greatest physiologic challenge to our body's oxygen transport system and the coordinated function of the respiratory, cardiovascular, and neuromuscular systems. Accordingly, exercise tests are many times the best strategy for determining the presence and severity of disease. A good example of this is the use of incremental exercise tests in assessing the degree of heart failure in patients, and then using maximal oxygen uptake as a guideline for treatment of these patients, including cardiac rehabilitation and the recommendation for cardiac transplantation. Today, there are a number of animal models of heart failure. These animal models have been used to answer many important questions about the heart failure syndrome. And the question is, what advantages may the animal model provide when compared to the human model? These include the investigator can control the disease severity and duration, the absence of or control over confounding drug treatments that may be found with the human model, greater control over subject numbers, diet, and exercise history, more freedom of invasive procedures such as muscle sampling, and finally, the inclusion of both acute and chronic exercise interventions. Now, I would like to go back to the heart failure condition. In 1979, Mark and Janice Pfeffer developed a rat model of heart failure induced by myocardial infarction. In the next two decades, numerous studies have been performed examining the effects of acute and chronic exercise in this animal model. The initial approach was to examine the effects of moderate endurance exercise training to mimic what was being used with the human heart failure patients. These investigations demonstrated that moderate endurance exercise training produced significant beneficial effects in both human and animal models. In 2001, Wisloff and colleagues developed a new approach in training heart failure rats. This new approach incorporated and was coined high-intensity interval training. Wisloff demonstrated that this new training regimen produced the greatest positive adaptations in both the heart and the peripheral circulation in heart failure rats when compared to their moderate endurance training counterparts. Most importantly, in 2007, Wisloff and colleagues demonstrated in a clinical study that high-intensity interval training was superior to moderate-intensity endurance training with heart failure patients. The take-home message here is that in many times, animal models set the stage and translate to the human condition, providing valuable information for setting up clinical trials. Dr. Poole?
In 1986, Charlie Tipton, the great physiologist and exercise expert, commented in an article that within a decade or two, animal testing protocols would have caught up to the state of the art in humans. And of course, it was really a moving target because the field of human exercise physiology has advanced a lot since then. For example, in 2017, Andy Jones and I wrote an article, a CORP article, Cause of Reproducibility in Physiology, for the Journal of Applied Physiology, on the state of the art in measuring VO2 max and the importance of including a validation belt to know if you've actually reached a VO2 max that is set or controlled or limited by the ability to transport and utilize oxygen rather than some mental or other thing that has caused the subject to stop the test. Now, that article was the best cited, I think, in the APS journals for the next couple of years. And it shows that this is a very current topic. What should we measure? How should we measure it properly? And that comes to the very basis of this article that we're discussing today. So what I thought the imperative would be for this was to show that we can measure VO2 max very, very well in animals. It's reproducible, highly reproducible. And Dr. Kopp will speak to that a little bit later, I believe. But also there's a parameter called critical power or critical speed that is very powerful for knowing what the system capabilities are. The comment could be made that animals and people rarely go to their maximal oxygen uptake. So the critical power is really a submaximal parameter that defines the maximum speed for which a human or animal can run or cycle at a certain metabolic rate. It's a simple measurement to do, but it takes great care. Dr. Kopp will address this a little later. You can have a system for measuring exercise tolerance in an animal that is reproducible within your laboratory. It also translates across laboratories and across treatment or therapeutic groups. So when Charlie Tipton also said to me one time, he said, we've trained some rats. He said, we've got a big increase in their muscle oxidative capacity from training as we expected, but their maximal oxygen uptake only went up about 8 or 10%. And yet these rats can run three times as long on average after training. What's happened? And so this power duration relationship, of which critical speed is one of the parameters, helps explain that. If you know your critical speed in a human or an animal, you know something very important about the ability of animals to run and to perform. And therefore, you have a really reproducible and accurate measurement of therapeutic efficacy, of training efficacy, and that in conjunction with the maximal oxygen uptake can be very powerful for characterizing exercise capacity. It translates very strongly from animals to humans.
Maybe Michael, you would like to comment?
I had the swine portion of the article. And with swine, there are a number of advantages and disadvantages. And actually, one of them might be that swine actually have a propensity towards sedentary habits. So they are the couch potato. And this is a bit different than dogs, which are, they're the superstar kind of athletes. And so it depends on what is the main goal of using the animal model. And if one wants to really study really sedentary habits, it be the swine, but they will get on the treadmill and they will run. A second advantage would be that they're monogastric and omnivorous. They'll basically eat a human type diet. And they also have a lipoprotein metabolism that's similar to humans. That is, they carry most of their lipoproteins in the low density lipoprotein fraction, which allows one then to study really atherosclerosis a bit better. In this larger size of pigs, considered a large animal, it's really advantageous to sample blood also during protocols. You know, one can easily sample 20 to 30 mLs per sample. And then having the cardiovascular system, the heart, very similar to humans, and the coronary circulation has been the big advantage over the years, both in terms of the anatomy of the circulation, the pharmacology of the arteries, vasoreactivity, and so forth. And actually, heart rate metabolic demand is very similar to humans. They can have a resting heart rate of 70 to 80 beats per minute in a sedentary animal, but then chronic training will bring that resting heart rate down to 50 or 60 beats, and so that's advantageous. And then one can do coronary interventions also in these animals and use same catheters that are used in humans and so forth. So, and then as David Poole and Tim Mush indicated, VO2 max is very important. And in the pig, the VO2 max per kilogram of body weight is very similar to untrained humans. So again, it makes them human-like. I would say that kind of a disadvantage is they are larger animals. It's an advantage and a disadvantage because it just is more labor intensive to use those. But I think the integrative responses that can be studied in the animals in these pigs really, I think, are one of the highlights of the use of the pig.
Thank you very much. Steve, would you like to comment?
So David mentioned a few things about the rat and critical speed specifically. So I'll piggyback off of those comments a little bit. In regards to the rats and the use of motorized treadmill running, there are a number of fairly straightforward and obvious advantages of the rat, including the number of disease models that are available, the ability to chronically instrument rats. But another thing that's very important is the confirmation of valid and reproducible endurance capacity, VO2 max, and critical speed protocols. And that's true in both healthy rats as well as in disease models of rats. And from a practical standpoint, one thing I wanted to provide a little bit of additional emphasis on, in addition to some of the strategies that are outlined in the review, where the strategies point to things that can be done to enhance the valid determination of these different performance measurements, is focus a little bit on this idea of the acclimatization periods. These acclimatization periods are usually very briefly mentioned in method sections, and I think from a practical standpoint, it's really critical for investigators to very carefully conduct and pay attention to the way that they conduct these acclimatization periods. I think the goal should be to actually teach the rats to run and to get to know the tendencies of the animals on the treadmill, as opposed to simply exposing them to treadmill running. And I think one of the key things that goes along with that is detailed record keeping of perhaps specific strategies that can be employed for each individual animal in terms of what is the best combination of techniques to get any individual animal to perform optimally on the treadmill. And optimally essentially means minimizing the stress while maximizing the performance of the animal. And so some of the things to keep in mind are what type of stimulus the animal might respond to. Some animals will respond poorly to certain stimuli, but might respond more positively to other types of stimuli. Also, the strength of a stimulus is going to be important to pay attention to. A lot of the animals that I've encountered can develop certain tendencies that you can pay attention to. And when you pick up on the tendencies, you can then develop very tailored mitigation strategies to help that animal perform more optimally. So, for example, sometimes you might have an animal that wants to turn in a specific time interval, and you can optimize the timing of the stimulus to prevent that from happening. Or perhaps they always are going to turn one direction, and you can optimize a strategy to prevent the animal from turning that one direction. Another thing with the acclimatization protocols that we always like to do is end acclimatization runs when the animal is running well. And that's performed in the hopes of avoiding rats learning that by running poorly, they'll get a treadmill run to stop. So we always like to stop the treadmill runs when the animals are performing well. And if you're performing VO2 max tests, a couple acclimatization runs inside a metabolic chamber might be appropriate. And so if these techniques are adopted in the practice and performance of an acclimatization period, we found that you don't need an acclimation run to a specific performance protocol, but that you can actually begin performance protocols and you'll have high degrees of reproducibility and validity with the first time a rat is subjected to that test.
Thank you, Steve. And maybe we can have some thoughts from Donald.
I was taken by the comments regarding training in the rat, how similar they are to the techniques we use to train dogs to the treadmill. One of the advantages of the dogs is that they are fairly easy to train to run the treadmill, and the vast majority of the animals really enjoy it. All you need to do is look on YouTube to see the many videos of dogs running on a treadmill. We use the same techniques of always trying to stop the treadmill when the animals are performing well so that they learn that. We also offer the animals copious amounts of verbal praise. You know, dogs have evolved to seek out humans and become part of our packs. We give them copious amounts of verbal praise, copious amounts of encouragement while they're exercising, much like when I worked in a human laboratory. Come on, you can do it. You can make it more. Not that they understand us, but I think they do get a feedback from our encouragement. And of course, treats at the end of the run, especially when they perform very well, and copious amounts of praise and petting. One trick that we've discovered is in an animal who's having difficulty training the treadmill, bring that animal in while we have a very well-trained animal running on the treadmill, and they will see the other animal, what they're doing, and very often want to join them on the treadmill. And we find that to be a very good training regime. The advantages of dogs are their size as well, much like the swine. You can implant a large variety of sensors into the animal to measure regional blood flows, ventricular functions, different pressures, all in the conscious, chronically instrumented animals, so you don't have detrimental effects of anesthetics or acute surgical trauma on cardiovascular responses, or do not have to use electrical stimulation of skeletal muscles to observe, but actually a breathing, conscious animal running on a treadmill, I think we have very reproducible responses. Also, the animals are very robust. Dogs have been used to study a wide number of disease states, ranging from heart failure, coronary artery disease, diabetes, hypertension. And one of the advantages is that many of these studies can be done in a longitudinal manner. That is, one can instrument the animal, run the control experiments, and then induce the disease state, and then rerun the experiment so that each animal serves as its own control. And this is very powerful statistically, and it also reduces the number of animals needed. There are disadvantages to using dogs in research, as was described. They are large animals. That's both an advantage and a disadvantage. So it does take a team. It takes a team to run the experiments. It takes a team to monitor the animals between studies, to do all the post-operative chronic care that's needed to keep the animals healthy and happy. And there are substantial costs involved with this, both in time and in resources to support the laboratory.
Irv, any additional comments?
This has been a really interesting discussion. I wrote the section on the use of rabbit in exercise, and I'll make a few comments about that, and then I think we can open it up for other questions that arose during the discussion. Rabbits are not a common species for exercise or for exercise training, but they do have some advantages. First of all, they're very docile. They're relatively easy to train, and they do, believe it or not, take well to treadmill training. One of the reasons we use them in our research is because we were interested in autonomic function in normal and heart failure states and the impact of exercise training on changes in autonomic function. And the rabbit is a model in which one can record electrophysiological activity from sympathetic nerves relatively easy. They don't move around a lot. They're sedentary, when they're not being trained. And so there's not a lot of movement artifacts. So we've done that. On the other hand, they're fragile animals. And they need a lot of care postoperatively if you're going to implant transducers and the like and catheters. And they don't do well under stress. The experimental paradigms that we've used for acute exercise and for exercise training is to use a human treadmill, which was modified with a plexiglass divider so that we could run two animals at a time. And there's a nice photo in the guidelines article showing this. We determined their ability to run, their maximal speed to exhaustion. And to get them, to entice them to run, we used air jet stress, which they do not like. In a box, when they're not running, they adapt pretty well to air jet. But on the treadmill, when they feel the air jet coming, when they lag behind, and they don't run like a dog, they kind of run up to the front of the treadmill, then they let the treadmill take them to the back, and then they get hit with the air jet, and then they run up again. So it's a little bit different than rats, mice, or dogs, or maybe even swine for that matter. But they do run, and you can get them to work pretty well. The other strategy that we have used, and I'd like other people to comment on this, is an exercise wheel. We built many years ago a very large exercise wheel that would accommodate a 3-kilogram rabbit, and it was motor driven. So we could set the speed at any speed we wanted, and as the rabbit goes to a vertical on the treadmill, he has no choice but to run to keep as horizontal as possible. And that worked pretty well because we could control the speed very precisely and we could train him every day over a period of time. That is not used very much anymore. There are no commercial exercise wheels that are made as far as I know. Columbus Instruments does make a rabbit treadmill which can be enclosed so one can measure oxygen consumption at the same time as they're running. And it has an electric grid on the back. We've tried this, and in our hands, rabbits didn't adapt to it very well. So the open concept of the human treadmill or the exercise wheel worked a lot better. So I think rabbits can be very useful, but one has to be careful in terms of stressing them too much, especially if they're in a disease state. So I'll stop there with the comments, but I would like to talk a little bit about exercise training paradigm rather than just maximal exercise assessment. I think there are different considerations when considering what the best paradigm is for exercise training animals over a long period of time versus their maximal ability to run. Anybody want to comment on that?
Irv, I can comment. This is Mike. You've raised a great point about chronic exercise training studies because we are interested, many of us are interested in the health effects of chronic exercise. And so at least in the pig, that's clearly possible. And that was our main objective in some of the studies we did and others, many others also. So we were not interested as much in maximum performance. And we really needed to have a protocol which would elicit, though, a classic training effect. And as we report in the article, another challenge was that we had diabetic animals, too, that could be subject to peripheral artery disease, neuropathy, et cetera. And so we really had to take that into consideration and have a moderate, realistic sort of training protocol. And we have one figure there showing a typical training exercise bout where we just do a warm up for about 10 minutes. And then they're really only in the kind of the target zone for a training effect of from 65 to 75% of max heart rate for 30 minutes and then do a cool down. And we've actually seen profound training adaptations in these animals. As a matter of fact, we showed with just 6 weeks of exercise training that could attenuate some of the coronary disease in these animals just with that sort of moderate training protocol. So I think those considerations are very important for sort of the practical use of any animal for a chronic study.
Those are great comments and very important. I just wondered, Tim, what are the endpoints that you would recommend people looking at when as trying to assess a training effect after chronic exercise?
Well, first, I'd like to comment on the early studies, training studies in rats, is that individuals usually put the rat on the treadmill maybe 10 or 15% grade, and they would over time have the rat obtain the speed of about 27 meters per minute or 1 mile per hour. And then they would just use that training stimulus over time. They wouldn't change it. And so, you know, the endpoints were usually increase in endurance capacity or VO2 max, along with the adaptations in the peripheral skeletal muscle, as indicated by an increase in oxidative enzyme capacity. Now, what Wisloff did in 2001 is that he introduced this high-intensity interval training. And what was really unique about this study was that he had his rats performing at a level of 90 to 95% of their VO2 max with short interval types of training. He measured VO2 max every week and then adjusted the workload upward. And when he did this, he found the highest increases or the greatest increases in maximal oxygen uptake either seen in normal rats or rats with heart failure. So again, the endpoint of VO2 max is reproducible and it's good to demonstrate a training effect. The other aspect that was brought up by David Poole is critical speed. I think that, you know, with critical speed, you have the ability to see changes associated with the rat's ability to increase critical speed with the endurance training regimen. The big advantage is with the disease models where you have animals that have lower levels of exercise capacity, but you can monitor, again, changes in critical speed over time. Now, why is that important? Well, if you take a look at individuals with heart failure who have a great diminished VO2 max in the neighborhood of between, let's say, 8 and 10 milliliters per minute per kilogram of body weight, these individuals during daily activities may be working at levels that exceed their critical speed. If with exercise training, if you can change the critical speed or the critical power, you can increase it over time in these individuals or in rats of different disease states, you can see that you increase, you know, their exercise tolerance and you increase their standard of living. So I would still use VO2 max and critical speed or other tests of endurance capacity as endpoints of showing efficacy of a training study.
That's very well taken. And I think a lot of people don't do that. And that's why studies are difficult to compare. Mario?
In humans, there are cases where excessive exercise actually leads to cardiac problems, particularly of the right ventricle. In some cases, actually mimicking a right ventricular cardiomyopathy. So I wonder if animals do get, or some animals do get to the point where excessive exercise can actually be deleterious to them, and whether they would be then a good model to study what some people have called the athlete's heart.
Maybe David can talk about the horse.
I was just going to jump in, so thank you for the kind invitation. So Leslie Young, she was at Newmarket, studied racehorses through their training period. So horses don't have a huge training response, particularly if they're bred for six millennia to have large hearts and racing capability, which they are. But when you start training a quality thoroughbred, about 50% of them will develop a valvular insufficiency. This doesn't mean that you don't have an animal now that can still achieve maybe 200 mils per kilogram per minute VO2 max. It's still a beautiful running machine, but it's not as good as it otherwise could be. It's losing some of its cardiac output potential because of that valvular insufficiency. So if you want to study heart problems, there's the potential for a racehorse to do that. But more commonly, racehorses suffer from exercise-induced pulmonary hemorrhage, where they actually rupture their lungs when they run. They have very, very high intravascular pulmonary arterial and vascular pressures, and they also generate on inhaling 120 times per minute, twice per second, at a rate of maybe 60 liters per second per nostril, very, very negative alveolar pressures. And those negative pressures summate with the positive intravascular pressures and rupture the exquisitely thin and fragile blood-gas barrier. So they're an excellent model of this exercise-induced pulmonary hemorrhage. They also, despite performing beautifully, have very small lungs for their heart size. And so what a horse will do when it starts to run is become hypoxemic and hypercapnic. So even though they're at a very much higher level of gas exchange than a human COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease patient, they will experience hypoxemia and hypercapnia and be a model of catastrophic lung failure, both in regards to exercise-induced pulmonary hemorrhage and also arterial hypoxemia. And those things have been studied quite well in horses, and we now understand them a lot better.
The other thing that, if you could comment, some people, I hear them doing free wheel running for their rodents, particularly for mice. Is that really a good method for having an exercise program or for looking for functional effects of exercise?
There are pros and cons, Mario, for that. Some of the pros include that it's voluntary. The animal, unless we have a motor-driven version of a running wheel, which is typically not used, it's a voluntary one. It allows the animals, rats or mice, to run at their own volition. Generally, they will do this in their dark cycle, in their nighttime, where they're very much more active. There's less incidence of foot injuries or nail injuries than there is on a treadmill. There is less of the coercive component, such as mild electric shock or compressed air blown on them that helps to encourage rats to run on treadmill or mice to run on treadmill. You don't need to do that. But what you can't do effectively is that you can't set how much activity you'd like the animal to do. And typically when you take a cadre of even inbred rats or mice, they will have the couch potato version down running maybe 1 to 2 kilometers a night. And up at the top end will be animals that run 10 times that. And so what investigators have done typically is have a cutoff for minimal activity. But again, you can't get a good measure of exercise capacity typically on these wheels. It's certainly not what you can do in the treadmill. And certainly it's very difficult to measure or set a metabolic rate. However, scientists like Timothy Lightfoot have used the wheel running in rodents as a lifetime model of activity. And this, of course, is very difficult, time intensive and expensive to do with a treadmill training study. And so allowing animals to have access to a running wheel throughout their entire lifetimes has provided some incredibly valuable cardiovascular information.
I'm curious about the couch potato. In doing treadmill running with mice, I have noticed that they are perfectly congenic animal lines that we have. And there are just plain and simple animals that like to run and some that aren't. Genetically, they should be the same. They have been treated the same. They are litter mates in some cases. But there are just animals that take up on the training much better than others. So is there anything that maybe intrinsic to the animal or to the cues that it takes from the environment that would help an investigator that wants to put a set of animals on a training program to choose which animal to use?
Yes, there are some good guidelines, certainly with respect to mice, for example. There are certain mice that run better than others. Within our review, we state that the Swiss Webster mice and also CD1 and FVB Brown Norways run much better, certainly, than the C57BL6J mice. It hasn't been well defined whether males or females of all of those species run better than others, but generally males are very good runners. I know that Tim, his favorites are female rats. Female rats tend to be more reliable runners. But even when you order in a set of rats that should all be good runners, typically it's advisable to build at least 10% extra in for animals that simply won't run. If you encourage, as Donald does, dogs on treadmills with praise, so you can encourage rodents on treadmills if they associate running with a positive experience. So a little piece of chocolate after the treadmill run given to the rats means they actually look forward to coming in and running on the treadmill. Looking after their toenails, for example, very carefully, and making sure that if you have an animal with a damaged toenail, you spot it early, withdraw the animal from the study, and give it a week or as much rest as necessary so it can come back and run without pain. For horses, one trick that we use with horses which normally enjoy running on the treadmill, they don't always enjoy putting on the mask that we use for the blow-by gas exchange measurements. And so what we do during our acclimatization period is that after the horse has been on the treadmill, it gets some oats or barley in a mask that looks just like the face mask that they'll use for gas exchange measurements subsequently. And that gives them a very positive association both with the treadmill and with the equipment. And I don't think this aspect to encouraging animals with a positive experience can be overestimated. It's very, very important indeed. And this also means for quality control and for humane reasons that you are very, very attentive to animals when they're running on a treadmill, that you spot problems early, whether it's a pig with its hooves, whether it's a dog with its nails or a rat with its nails, or some other kind of injury, which may be very uncommon, but when it happens, it's good to spot it early and take corrective action.
Well, that's great. I wonder if there would be any final thoughts from any of you.
So I believe looking at the different animal models that we have and several of which we mentioned in this review, the investigator has a smorgasbord of opportunities. There will always be issues as to how well an animal model in health or disease relates to humans. But I will point out that over 80% of the Nobel Prizes in physiology or medicine have gone to animal-based work or work that began with animal models. The great Claude Bernard and also Augustine Berg-Krogh, a little later, the Nobel laureate, both said that for every physiological or medical problem we have, there is an animal model designed specifically to address it. And I think that kind of power we see in what animals can do for us in animal exercise studies, training and exercise studies themselves can do for us. Whereas it might not tell you exactly what's happening in a human, although sometimes it gets very, very close indeed. What it does is it enables you to see the opportunities. It enables you to derive hypotheses with a depth of understanding and measurements very often that we simply can't get in humans.
I would like to just add a few comments if I can. Yeah, when David said that rats like chocolate, they prefer Cocoa Puffs, you know, from experience. The other thing, dealing with genetics, the work of Stephen Britton and Lauren Koch should be brought in because they took high performers and low performers and bred them. And they had clear demarcation of exercise performance between the high performers and the low performers through very few generations. I think it was 6 or 7 generations of breeding. So again, with the mice and the rat, there seems to be some inherent genetic component that may be associated with exercise performance.
I really appreciate David and Tim in doing this. It's really a feather in AJP's cap, I think, to have you guys author this paper, because there's absolutely nobody better in the world to talk about, especially rodent exercise. I mean, you are the go-to people, the gold standard, and I really appreciate it.
Just like there's no I in team, there's no I in me, and there was no I in this. There was, you know, a fantastic team that came right from APS, AJP Hart, Cara, Irv, for the invitation and the incentive and the kick up the jacksy. And without our amazing colleagues, collaborators, doing the lion's share of the work, it wouldn't have been a project at all. So I'd like to thank everyone that's been involved and that helped drive this thing through. So many thanks.
And the same with me. I mean, we couldn't have done it without everybody participating.
Well, then I will pass it back to Cara.
Thanks for listening. Would you like to hear more? Visit the AJP Heart and Circulatory Physiology homepage for our latest episodes.